This is Audible.
Welcome to Wild Blue Yonder, a novel of the 1960s, written by Jack B. Rochester and narrated by Len Malo. Part 1, Air Force Blues. Chapter 1, Me or Them. January 19, 1965, 5:45 a.m. I stood outside the Chicago Loop bus terminal with my mother. Huge, sopping, wet snowflakes struck the umbrella I held above us like mallet blows on a kettle drum. Icy water cascaded over its edge, soaking my shoes. I hated getting wet feet. I hated the cold. I hated everything about being here, waiting for a bus that would take me to San Antonio, Texas, to begin my 4-year prison sentence in the United States Air Force. Dozens of strangers my age stood around in a tableau that reminded me of nothing so much as a dark, bleak, miserable, chiaroscuro version of my favorite painting at the Chicago Art Institute, Sorot's Sunday Afternoon on Le Grand Jatte. I looked at a tall fellow in a tan private eye overcoat, darkened across the shoulders by the wet snow, who glared back at me. Near the terminal doors, a guy jabbered loudly into the payphone, his free arm swinging in wild arcs. He was loudly sobbing, "Lauren! Lauren!" Embarrassed, I shifted my gaze to those who paced incessantly in and out of the ice-cold rain without benefit of umbrellas. A sleazy hood in a black leather motorcycle jacket, his hair carved into fins on each side of his head, and a cigarette dangling from surly lips, sneered at everyone who walked near him. I caught a look of utter dejection on a long-haired, pimply-faced kid who stood next to a stocky, older man, their hands and wrists covered by a thick neck scarf. I sighed loudly in an unsuccessful attempt to get my mother's sympathy. I couldn't stand this, waiting in the cold, gray darkness. I just didn't want to think about where my life was headed once I embarked upon the impending bus ride. A powerful gust of bitterly cold, damp wind blew off Lake Michigan through the bus terminal. My mother, Adele, although bundled up inside her thick wool car coat, shook, shivered, and shuddered. What a jerk I was, causing her this anguish. More anguish. Anguish upon anguish. Just when she was beginning to get over the loss of my dad and now me flunked out of the University of Chicago, fired from a construction job as a mere manual laborer. A draft notice from the Army, then that little talk at the kitchen table. "Nathaniel," she said, "I think it's time you go in the service." The military. The service. Serve my country. So that was it. No discussion, no alternatives. The service. That was the only option left for someone like me. A big silver Greyhound bus pulled up, splashed slush at us, and stopped with an ear-splitting wheeze. The door opened, and the driver emerged wearing a natty uniform, his captain's hat tipped back on his head. Everyone watched him trot into the terminal without a glance, a smile, even a grimace. I looked back at the bus. Beside the door was a small oval window that displayed the bus's destination. It read, "Charter, San Antonio." It might just as well have displayed Dante's exhortation, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." This bus would take us to Lackland Air Force Base for induction and basic training. Something thumped in the pit of my stomach. I glanced around. Others were lining up, toting gym bags like my own, with those things the recruiter told us we could bring. Mine held a toothbrush and powder, my Norelco electric shaver, a change of clothes, and a few books. Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, Mark Van Doren's biography of my namesake, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Joyce's Ulysses, and a recent paperback, The Catcher in the Rye, by someone named Salinger, of whom I had heard praise. We stood around for another 15 minutes or so, but it felt like an hour. Nobody was making a move to board the idling bus, its stinking exhaust blowing right at us. The driver emerged from the terminal and ran lightly up the steps as he shouted, "Board!" over his shoulder. He jumped into the driver's seat and hit the gas a few times, spewing clouds of fumes. My mother intuitively grasped that at this moment, her parental responsibilities were at an end. A librarianship graduate from a small women's college in Minnesota, the name escapes me, she'd spent her entire adult life as a wife and mother to me and my two little brothers, Ernest and Francis Scott, 6 and 7 years my junior. With my father's sudden death a year and a half earlier, he was only 43 and my mom 39, she was forced into retail commerce, selling ladies' undergarments to women of means far greater than her own. I wondered whose ignominy was greater, hers or mine. But what made me the saddest was my poor little brothers, the lost look on their faces. I don't think they were able to understand what happened to our dad. Arms crossed tightly against the cold, she turned to me and said, "Nate, our dear departed president, John F. Kennedy, said that a young man who lacks the fortitude to perform military service is, oh, I can't remember the rest. Your father was proud to serve his country. Make yourself proud to serve, too." I looked her right in the face, but the words I wanted to say wouldn't come. She must have seen something in my eyes, though, because in an uncommon act for her, she hugged me and gave me a peck on the cheek. My father, John Flowers, served in the Navy during World War II. He died August 10, 1963, less than a month before I was to commence my college career. His heart failed while on his usual early morning run in Washington Park. He was gone before the ambulance arrived. He taught English, he called it rhetoric, and American literature at Emily Dickinson High School in Waukegan. He left me two gifts, if that's what you want to call them. One was my name, Nathaniel Hawthorne Flowers, after the man he regarded as the greatest writer in American literature. He named my two little brothers after his second and third favorites, Ernest Hemingway and Francis Scott Fitzgerald. Dad invariably called me as Nathaniel, never Nate, as my mom usually did. The second gift was a love of the world's great literature. Our house was a veritable library, filled with thousands of books residing on clumsily made bookshelves my father built himself. I never wanted for something to read, whether it was a classic by Henry James or Charles Dickens, a modern novel by Robert Rourke or John Steinbeck, or even one of the lasciviously sexy and violent mysteries of Mickey Spillane. Once or twice a week, Dad would tell Ernest and Frankie and me the story of one of the great novels in our library. He didn't just tell the story, either. He acted it out, changed his voice for different characters, then, at the end, told us what it meant. Afterwards, I'd often grab the book from his hands and race off to my room to read it. Sometimes I'd read it to my brothers, but their taste mostly ran to comic books about the Lone Ranger or Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. I came to believe that everything good, even great, about understanding life was in those stories. My father frequently announced to anyone nearby that I would surely follow in my namesake's footsteps and become a great writer. I wrote my first short story in my Big Chief tablet when I was 14 years old. It was entitled, "I Am a Rock," about a large talking boulder in City Park. When I read it to my brothers, Ernest said, "Rocks don't talk, Nate." I looked toward the bus, which my anonymous brothers in arms were stoically boarding. I turned back to my mother, but still found myself unable to utter a word. She gave me a deep, long, possibly sad gaze and said, "Write me." A sudden panic, such as Raskolnikov might have experienced, flashed through my mind. no turning back. I had to leave now. A desire to tell my mother of my attempted suicide rose up inside, but just as quickly I realized that making such an admission was A, unlikely to engender any sympathy, since I was clearly still alive, and B, would do nothing to keep me off this bus. In the case of A, it was far more likely she would think I, the writer, was fabricating another of my wild fictions. In the case of B, I had already signed the enlistment agreement, and not even a mother's love could give me reprieve from that. Like it or not, this was a bus ride to my destiny. "Thanks, Mom," I said, "for everything," almost as if I meant it. "Bye." I took a step toward the bus. "Nathaniel," my mother cried. I stopped. I was still holding the umbrella, and it had tipped, drenching her in melted snow. She snatched it, glared at me, turned on her heel, and headed for the terminal. "Take good care of my car," I called after her. For safekeeping, I had signed the title to my 1958 Plymouth Golden Fury over to her, a special edition two-door hardtop with gold trim. It was the most beautiful car ever made. I had earned all the money to buy it from my construction job before I was fired. My Fury mattered more to me than anything in my whole life. She glanced quickly, unsmilingly, over her shoulder. "And don't let my little toad brothers get into my stuff." This time she didn't look back. Outside the bus door stood the fat man and the pimply kid, seemingly in a wrestling match, until I saw the handcuffs that joined them. He set the boy loose and gave him a shove up the stairs. A little taken aback, I clambered aboard, spied an empty row, shoved my gym bag into the overhead rack, pulled off my coat, rolled it into a ball, stuffed it next to my bag, and flopped into the window seat. Moments later, the driver swooshed the door shut, crammed the bus into gear with a great gnashing, and jerked away from the terminal, calling over his shoulder, "Sit back and relax, boys. It's a long, long ride to San Antone." You can say that again. I looked out the window, hoping to see my mother one last time, but she was gone. I leaned back and squirmed around, trying to get comfortable enough to fall asleep. I pulled my damp coat down and stuck it against the window for a pillow. I squeezed my eyes shut as tight as I could, but even at this ungodly hour of 6 in the morning, to which I was a complete stranger, sleep would not come. The seat creaked. I glanced to my left. Beside me was a rather chubby boy with reddish-blonde hair and a flagrant cowlick, a broken front tooth, and a large, friendly smile. He stuck a hand toward me and said, "Howdy. I'm Dennis Marshfield from Louisville, Kentucky. How y'all doing?" "Nathaniel," I said, shaking his hand. "Nathaniel Hawthorne Flowers of Waukegan, just north of Chicago." "Nice to meet you, I'm sure. Y'all look like you could use some company." "Oh, sure. Just what I wanted." "My middle name is Athabasca, on account of my granddaddy on my mother's side. Dennis Athabasca Marshfield. Now, that's a mouthful, ain't it?" He laughed. I smiled. "He ran a lathe, made hickory baseball bats, my granddaddy. Louisville Sluggers. So did my daddy. Suppose I would have, too, except for the draft." We were both silent for a while. Then he said, "Flowers. Now, that's an unusual last name." I told Dennis Marshfield about my father's occupation and his passing in the fewest words possible. "I'm right sorry to hear that," he replied. "Did you go off to college anyways?" I nodded. Even though I'd been on the honor roll the last 6 semesters at Waukegan High, even though I'd received a full academic scholarship, the University of Chicago intimidated the hell out of me. I got off to a bad start, and that's pretty much where I stayed all year. Try as I might, I just didn't feel like I fit in at Chicago. Everyone seemed smarter and more sophisticated than me. I had trouble making friends, but that wasn't anything new. For some reason, I lacked the enthusiasm or energy to do much of anything. Inside, I just felt bad, 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 and didn't know why. I spent most of my time sleeping, drinking, or playing cards. Were I a football player, it would have been said that I had hit the records for fumbles. In my case, the fumbles were scholastic. I slogged through my first quarter, got 2 B's, a D, and an F, and was put on academic probation. Winter quarter was a struggle, but I got my grades up to a C average. Then spring quarter. I eclipsed my fall quarter grades with all D's, F's, and an incomplete. "And you, did you go to college?" I asked, hoping to avoid any further discussion of my dismal self. "Nah," he shook his head and grinned, that broken-off tooth catching his lower lip. A red scar told me this happened frequently. "Nah, I ain't college material. Besides, I ain't but 18 years old. I got out of high school last spring, and right away the Army was a-biting at my heels, I tell you." He laughed lightly, without a trace of irony. I laughed with him. "Yeah, me as well." "You found it preferable to spend 4 years in the Air Force to 2 years in the Army?" "What I found preferable was not toting a rifle in the swamps of Vietnam killing folk." "Indeed, I agree. I say, Marshfield, what career field did you sign up for?" "Ah, fixing something. I do not rightly recall what it was, but it sounded interesting and like something I could do." He twisted his neck and looked up at the luggage racks across the aisle, then whipped his face back toward mine. "Simulators? That sound like something?" "Flight simulators?" I queried. "That's it," he cried, slapping his hands together. "How about yourself, Nate?" Already he had lapsed into the familiar truncation of my name, which nettled me. "Jet pilot," I replied. "Well, now I'll be hanged," Marshfield said. "Dang, don't that beat all. Y'all gonna be flying a jet airplane, shooting off machine guns, dropping bombs, getting in them dogfights with them bad old Vietnamese and all. Hot damn, Nate, don't that beat all." I sat silent. Truth be told, I hadn't much thought about this aspect of piloting high-speed fighter aircraft, my imagination not having taken me much beyond the romantic vision of the dashing Air Force officer and his sleek, glimmering jet plane. Nor had I considered I would be sent to Vietnam, the avoidance of which was the reason for joining the Air Force instead of the Army. I thought back to how I'd arrived at this choice. After receiving the summons from the Army, and at my mother's, shall I say, encouragement, I stopped by the Waukegan post office to visit with the Navy and Air Force recruiters. They were appallingly like car salesmen and tried with all their might to get me to enlist on the spot. At first, I was inclined toward the Navy because it was my father's choice, but when I learned I'd be on a nuclear sub at the bottom of one ocean or another for 6 years, I lost all interest. The Air Force recruiter said that since I'd been to college, I could become a fighter pilot. My imagination was rife with the opportunities for success I so passionately craved. The recruiter said he'd put it in writing, but it was guaranteed only for 24 hours, so I accepted his offer. I asked for and got 60 days before I had to report, which would mean I'd be home for Christmas and New Year's, my 20th birthday. Then it would be off into the wild blue yonder. We spent 31 hours on the bus to Lackland. Groggy upon arrival, we were met by two crass soldiers wearing crisp tan uniforms and flat-brimmed hats like the Illinois State Police. They said they were our training instructors, or TIs, and immediately began belittling us. One was a huge Negro named Lowry, clearly in top physical condition, who introduced himself as a technical sergeant. The other was a staff sergeant named Johansson, an overweight, belligerent monster with steely blue eyes and dirty blonde hair, obviously a Lutheran from Minnesota. They said they were in charge of us for the next 6 weeks of basic military training, or BMT, the purpose of which was to destroy our civilian personalities and crush our wills, thereby transforming each and every one of us into an obedient soldier. This would occur through a rigorous regimen of physical conditioning and classroom training. It sounded absolutely dreadful, and I wondered again how I'd gotten myself into this. Lowry and Johansson both immediately began yelling at us, calling us rainbows, talking over one another and contradicting each other's orders. Try as we might, we didn't seem to be able to do anything right for them. They screamed us into two rows and marched us to the in-processing center, where we had our heads shaved, our buttholes examined, and our arms shot up with who knows what all vaccinations. We were ordered to empty our duffel bags and relieved of all our possessions except our civvies. I protested having to relinquish my treasured books, which the TIs found quite humorous for some reason. "You ain't gonna have no time for reading," Johansson said, and viciously threw my treasures into a large steel waste bin. We were issued dog tags and fatigues and marched to a vast mess hall where we were fed some kind of salty muck on burned toast. Serendipitously, Marshfield and I were reunited and, along with other rainbows, marched to a building referred to as a barracks. We were told that the 40 of us were officially Flight 09 of the 3711th Squadron. The process of destroying our individuality began. Right from the start, I was certain Lowry and Johansson despised me. Although I tried awfully hard to be responsible, to learn, to get things right, it seemed they went out of their way to find fault with me. I was convinced they were harder on me than any of the other rainbows. I can't say I particularly liked either of them, but I came to look up to Tech Sergeant Lowry. He was consistent in his orders, and even when doling out punishment, for example, giving a rainbow 50 push-ups for improperly presenting arms or wearing scuffed brogans, he was fair and just. I respected his military bearing, and I found myself trying to emulate him. Johansson, on the other hand, would be viciously strict one day and conciliatory the next, seemingly without rhyme nor reason. After spending the first few days of BMT in what I can only describe as a state of near continual shock and fear, one night the TIs took me into their little office in our barracks. I immediately assumed I was in trouble for something. "At ease, Flowers," Tech Sergeant Lowry said. Staff Sergeant Johansson pointed to a chair, and I sat. They were both rather cordial, and we chatted about how it was all going. "What career field did you sign up for?" Lowry asked. "Pilot, jet airplane pilot," I replied. The TIs burst into laughter. I looked quizzically at them. Lowry rocked back and forth on his chair, while Johansson glared at me with his watery blue eyes as if I were an idiot. "Flowers," he said, "you're an enlisted airman. Enlisted troops don't fly aircraft. Officers fly aircraft. Do you have a college degree?"
Dumbfounded, I shook my head. "Only college graduates can become officers, Flowers," said Lowry, somewhat more kindly, perhaps pitiably.
"Who told you you'd be a pilot?" Johansson snapped.
"My recruiter," I replied. They burst into laughter again. I felt so stupid that my face burned. If I wasn't going to become a fighter pilot, then what? Had I screwed up again?
"Well, Flowers, seems your recruiter recognized your leadership potential," said Lowry, then proceeded to tell me they were making me the dorm chief. I had no idea what this meant, so they explained I was in charge of the flight when they were not present. They gave me a braided rope to wear on my shoulder, representing my new authority. BMT taught us how to march, salute, shoot a rifle, straighten the gig line, eat fast, wait, wait, and wait some more, spit shine brogans, make a bed so snugly a quarter bounced on it.
We memorized officer and enlisted ranks and insignia, the military code of conduct, and an absolute plethora of other military conventions. The experience was so mindless and absurd that I had absolutely no idea how I was faring. But my appointment as dorm chief inspired the belief that I was capable of excelling. I began giving my flight pep talks, for example, on the importance of esprit de corps. I was particularly keen on asserting how we were a team and must defer our individual selves to the good of the group. My assumption was that the other troops could easily grasp this fundamental instruction and see its practicality. However, this was not the case. I quickly came to realize these troops had no interest in the honor of serving the military of our country, a notion I had now come to embrace. Moreover, I was no longer one of them. I was now the kiss-ass of the TIs, whom everyone hated, and now they hated me as well. It was profoundly distressing. What I had thought would bind me more closely in the brotherhood of the uniform had instead rent the fabric we had supposedly been creating with such perseverance. Even as I recited to them the affirmation of Dumas' famed Three Musketeers, unus pro omnibus, omnis pro uno, I knew it was nothing but a cruel fiction. In reality, we were not one for all and all for one, but were and would forever remain me for me. As the weeks passed, my disappointment and regret turned to abject bitterness, and my demeanor, I'm sure, became more officious and authoritarian. My outlook was further despoiled when it became evident the military was just like the town without pity in Gene Pitney's song, ruthlessly washing out those who weren't up to snuff. For example, the TI started picking on a fat kid named Dillman, threatening him if he didn't lose weight. Once the TIs began, the troops joined in on him. I recalled how Piggy was ostracized in Lord of the Flies, except with Dillman, we went out to drill one day, and when we came back, he was gone. Then there was Nichols, a tall, quiet troop from West Virginia. He rarely spoke, kept to himself, and never caused anyone a moment's trouble. Well, at noon chow, he poured an entire bottle of French's prepared mustard all over his food, meat, potatoes, ice cream, cake, everything. Then he ate every bite on his plate while we sat there staring at him. By the end of the day, he disappeared too. One day on smoke break, Marshfield took me aside. "Nate, they's some boys who's got shivs." Handmade knives were referred to as shivs, and possessing any kind of weapon was, of course, forbidden by regulation. After discreetly questioning a few other troops, the rumor seemed confirmed. It was three Mexicans from Southern California who had enlisted in the so-called buddy system. I knew my duty was to inform the TIs, but part of me argued that to do so was to dishonor the Musketeers' credo in which I so passionately believed. Thus, torn asunder, I stalled and did nothing. Our 6 weeks had whittled down to 2 days remaining until graduation, and everybody was jazzed. Our flight photograph was taken. Soon we would be on our way to our various training assignments. Lowry and Johansson, finally satisfied with our marching and dress right salutes, had been lightening up on us, promising we'd get a pass to go off base into San Antonio. As I did every night, I performed last inspection and bed check, then called lights out at 21:30 hours. I don't know how long I'd been asleep, not long, when the instructors came banging through the doors, running up and down between our bunk beds, screaming at the top of their lungs, "Get up! Get out! Get the fuck out of here!" We were all terrified. What was going on? We scrambled into our fatigues and raced out into the night. An awaiting bus took us to an aircraft hangar. We fell in, and two air police, armed with rifles, escorted us double file into the hangar. No one spoke or even looked at one another. It felt even colder inside than outside. Johansson came in and ordered us to attention, then parade rest. We stood there for what seemed like an hour, then he came back in with the APs and said we could fall out for a smoke break. We lit up and milled around, asking each other what was going on. A truck pulled up, and we watched two troops unload our footlockers outside. I looked at my watch. 0230 hours. Johansson began screaming at us, extremely angry.
Stay away from those footlockers and field strip those butts. I don't want to see even one single fucking ash on this fucking concrete, he said, or this whole squad will be scrubbing this deck down for the entire fucking night. Now, Jen Hutt!
We snapped to attention. Then after half an hour or so, Lowry yelled, at ease. The TIs came in and out screaming, Ten Hut, at ease, parade rest, fall out, fall in, Ten Hut, over and over. The APs in dress blues, polished boots, white helmets and gloves guarded us like we were prisoners of war. I had no idea what was happening and was desperately afraid. Fear drove me to approach Tech Sergeant Lowry. I said, Sir, as dorm chief, maybe I could talk to the troops, sir? Tell them what we're doing here, you know, put their minds at ease, sir? He gave me a cruel look and said, Take that rope off, Flowers. You're not no dorm chief no more. I was crushed by his brutality. This man, whom I had come to respect, was now treating me with abject cruelty. Why? Had I not served him well? I unbuttoned the rope, handed it to him, and walked back to the ranks in humiliation. As dawn began to break, a half dozen buses pulled up outside. The TIs came in, and Johansson barked,
Listen up. We're going to give you your training base assignments. Try to follow instructions for once, all right?
Lowry called a troop's name. He stepped forward. Lowry handed him his orders. Then he fell out into his group. I received mine. I was to report to Keesler Air Force Base, Biloxi, Mississippi. Each group marched to their own bus. Six of us, including Dennis Marshfield and myself, were the last. I looked back into the hangar. The three Mexicans were still inside. We boarded the transport aircraft and strapped into the long bench seat that ran along the hull. Soon we were in the air. Dennis Marshfield had taken the seat beside me. He leaned over and said, I told the TIs. Huh, I said, still reeling from the night's experience. About the Mexicans, planning to kill y'all. 'Twarn't right, he said, shaking his big head back and forth. Kill me? I asked, incredulous. What? The Mexicans? Wanted to kill me? I broke out into a cold sweat. Yep, Morales and Gutierrez and Pacheco. I heard them talking about it. Them boys, they're in a street gang back home. Got in a little trouble. Judge told him join the military or go to jail. He paused. Gonna shiv y'all, 'cause you was dorm chief, he said. I was jolted by the memory of the pimply-faced kid in handcuffs. So you knew they were going to stab me last night? Nah, I didn't know when. Maybe tonight. Maybe tomorrow night in San Antone. They were quiet, those three, and always kept to themselves. What I didn't know was that they hated me, or apparently hated the authority I represented so much. So I told them, you know, said Marshfield, shaking his head, the TIs. 'Twarn't right. Well, thanks, Marshfield, I replied. Denny, buddy, thanks a lot. I put out my hand to shake, but he didn't seem to notice. I didn't like you being dorm chief none neither, you know. Acting like you was a big shot with all your highfalutin talk and all, but killing you for it. So this was how I was perceived by my fellow troops. It wasn't the way I thought of myself, nor how I wished to be thought of by others. No, not at all. The plane bucked, bouncing Denny and me up and down in our harnesses. I looked at him and smiled. He smiled back, his chipped buck tooth scraping his lip. The propellers roared with an awful din as the plane began gaining altitude. I leaned back and closed my eyes. Within moments, I was sound asleep.